This is April 10th, 2016, welcome again to those of you who are listening to this live in other parts of the state or the country or the world. I probably won't keep saying that, but it still is kind of exciting to me to think that our Zendo has expanded and lost its walls, and there are people now who are, in effect, sitting with us, and we're sitting with you in your living rooms and bedrooms and all. I'm going to devote this Teisho to the environment, Buddhist environmentalism. I discovered in preparing for this that there's an immense literature just in this 21st century about the very intimate connection between the Buddhist experience and sensitivity, awareness of the environmental dangers and what we can do about them. I'm going to focus for the most part on the kind of resistance, the various forms of resistance that many of us feel in getting more actively involved in the environment, environmental movement. Because I think if without such resistance, we would many of us would be more involved, because we are facing what I think most scientists will consider a real catastrophe, not immediately, but over the next few decades. But we can't wait that long. But I'm going to start with an entry in a book by our own longtime Sangha member, Kenneth Kraft. And this, he's written a number of books. This one is called The Wheel of Engaged Buddhism, A New Map of the Path. The title, The Wheel, refers to a structure, a conceptual understanding of the different ways that we can understand environmentalism, let's say. And one chapter of that is called Caring for the Earth. Excuse me, not just environmentalism. The book is about engaged Buddhism, broadly speaking, of which environmentalism is just one aspect. In this essay by Ken, he says, the practices characteristic of this path, broadly speaking, are restraint and stewardship. Restraint grounded in ecological awareness means being conscious of what one consumes, distinguishing between real needs and artificial desires, and finding ways to live more simply. Here is a critical point of intersection between ecology and economics. How much is enough? A maxim of the voluntary simplicity movement is live simply so that others may simply live. If the meaning of others is expanded to include non-humans, the adage still stands. Contrary to expectation, this kind of restraint is not a grim exercise in self-denial. The true spirit of downshifting has been captured on a bumper sticker. Less consumption, more joy. It almost goes without saying that the very essence of respect for all forms of life, animal, plant, and every other species, comes from an awareness of the interdependence of everything. Or another way of putting that is an awareness that everything is our own self. This is the very root of it. We can work from the outside. We can go to lectures and read books and convince ourselves that what we ought to be doing, the right thing to be doing, is to be more restrained and responsive to environmental dangers. But the real heart of it comes down to this, to awareness of our interconnectedness with all species, all things. And this is something that grows through Zen practice. It's a byproduct of Zen practice. It will happen. If we practice long enough, we will find ourselves becoming more aware of that what we call things and other beings are not other. It's our own true self. Dogen famously said, "You think that your mind is thoughts and concepts, but actually is mountains and rivers and grasses and stones." Words deceive us. Most people think of the mind, the self, or the mind as being in the individual. But long practice in Zen, and especially some degree of awakening, reveals that this is a artificial division, that all things are this one self, capital S. Sun and the moon and the stars and the great wide earth. I am the sun and the moon and the stars and the great wide earth. I think that was Hakuin who said that. Restraint. Related to that is not wasting. This is a basic tenet of Zen training, traditionally, even long before there was any wide concern about climate change or any of these other environmental disasters. There was this adherence in the Zen temples and monasteries to a practice of not wasting, and we try to uphold that here at the Zen Center, not leaving lights burning when they're not needed, not allowing faucets to run any longer than they need to be running. So, for example, when washing the hands, if you do a thorough washing the way they say you're supposed to, be 14 seconds, or I've heard others, it's supposed to be 18 or something, but there's no need when you're soaping your hands to have the water continue to run. You just get your hands soaped up enough, turn off the faucet, do your soaping, and then turn it back on to rinse them. It may seem so obsessive to some people, but I'm convinced that anyone who practices long enough will find that it's painful to see even waste on such a small scale. To have the water gushing out is painful. And maybe the most painful is wasting food. This is so, it's so challenging when preparing meals. Who can, what cook can gauge exactly what people's appetites will be, how much will be needed? And so then you have leftovers and you try to find use of the leftovers, but all of this comes naturally, this sensitivity to the ultimate value of things, so-called things, which is again our own hands and feet and limbs. This grows and grows and grows through practice. And how does that happen? Well, as we learn to detach from thoughts, then we come to see the way things are. The way things are interconnected. All things are one. And this just happens over time. This growing awareness, and then the action, the restraint follows from the awareness. And then the other value here that Ken mentions is stewardship. Stewardship is conduct that aims to protect humans, other creatures, and the earth's resources. The watering of a plant is a down-to-earth example. This is one of the images on this wheel that Ken came up with, the Wheel of Engaged Buddhism. One can be watering the seeds of awareness at the same time. Well, that's whenever, not just while sitting, but whenever we are fully present and not caught in our thoughts, then this is watering the seeds of awareness. Joanna Macy, the great Buddhist environmentalist Joanna Macy, came up with the term nuclear guardianship. And Ken here says, since it may not be possible to contain radioactive waste through technological means alone, Macy envisions an ongoing role for human guardians, a collective form of mindfulness that would have to be sustained generation after generation. There are these very basic Buddhist teachings that you've all heard in Taisho and probably in your reading, and hopefully some in your own experience through practice, that of impermanence. And, for example, and this understanding is amplified today by the enormous loss of species that we're seeing. Ken writes here, the notion of interdependence helps to shed light on the role of humans in the food chain. The doctrine of karma, if extended to the moral implications of actions affecting the environment, adds a Buddhist point of view to environmental ethics. A first law of eco-karma might be, what we do to the earth, we do to ourselves. He says several of these themes come to life in the work of Stephanie Kaza, who approaches environmental problems from a systems perspective. When a mixed cord of wood is delivered to her doorstep, she discovers that some of the wood is from distant sources and realizes that the local supply of wood is being over-harvested. Refilling the tank of her chainsaw with a mix of gas and oil, Kaza continues to reflect. Gas and oil from where? The Persian Gulf, Alaska, off the coast of Southern California? Through what war zones or ice flows has this gas traveled before entering the chainsaw? How much has it already cost in transportation and energy to produce this liquid gold? The chainsaw, she says, brings us to the point of intimacy, the hinge point around which all aspects of the story turn: fire, woodpile, oil, mind, danger, connection, each interpenetrating in the meeting place of our bodies. This is an example of how she reflects on such moments, at such moments. And that's wonderful. The other way is it just happens naturally, as we just said. We become attuned to the interconnectedness of all things through practice. There's also the concept of ignorance as one of the three poisons. Actually, I think a more accurate way to understand the three poisons, the third of the three poisons, is delusion or confusion. But all three, greed, anger, and delusion, arise from ignorance, ignorance of the way things are, the true nature of things. And Ken points out that we seem to be increasingly ignorant of our place in nature. How many of us know where our water comes from or where our garbage goes? Ken also brings out this famous movement by the Buddha at his enlightenment, when right before his enlightenment, when he was assailed by the forces of self-doubt that's personified in legend, in Buddhist myth, as Mara. Mara and his team swoops down on the Buddha sitting underneath the Bodhi tree, and tries to get the Shakyamuni to back off, at which point the Buddha just reached down with his right hand and lightly touched the earth, because the earth had intimately witnessed his long course of spiritual exertion. And Ken poses the question, is being in touch with the earth linked to enlightenment in ways that have not been fully examined? Could this distinctive image double as a symbol of profound spiritual and ecological awareness? It's a beautiful thought, an image. Some of you may have noticed, and others not, that this is one of the forms that a Buddha figure is made, and you see the right hand of the Buddha touching the earth. I think this is a excellent interpretation, that so long as we are truly aware, then we will be in touch with not just the earth. That's a broader reference to the environment, the world we live in, the skies, the waters, and the earth. I also came across a text, a short text, that was included with the Sierra Club engagement calendar of 1995. It's a statement by the executive director of the Sierra Club at the time, Carl Pope. It really, I found myself reading it and rereading it. It was so moving to me. He talks about his own shift in awareness, his turn toward environmental awareness. When he discovered the joys of sleeping in a tent, and also the first time he saw a deer hurtle soundlessly across a thin strip of blacktop and vanish into the dark and fathomless woods. He says, we've all experienced such moments when we feel humbled by the sheer, uncompromising majesty of the world we inhabit. When we understand, less with our minds than with our hearts, what Hamlet means when he tells his learned friend, there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. He continues, it's that moment when you realize, whether for the first time or the thousand and first, that you're not the center of the universe, and far from feeling diminished by the realization, you feel more a part of the world than you'd ever dreamed was possible. That, of course, is the first step toward becoming an environmentalist. And then he reviews the way that that the human's place in the universe has changed, with especially in the 16th century when Copernicus asserted that the sun, not the earth, was the center of things. Eventually, this simple idea that in the music of the spheres, ours is but a single voice, paved the way for major scientific advances, from Kepler's laws of planetary motion to Newton's theory of universal gravitation. It remains, after 400 years, the foundation of modern astronomy. So it is with the natural world. There are those who proclaim man's supremacy, and then he puts in parentheses, yes, in this particular worldview, the male of the species reigns supreme, man's supremacy over his environment, who insist on his central place in the natural order. This, of course, is not Buddhist teaching. It's not the experience of awakening. How can you reconcile that with the interdependence of everything? From this perspective, propagated on radio call-in shows and industry-sponsored wise use conventions, wise use is in quotation marks, trees equal timber, mountains mean minerals, and the only good wetland is a paved wetland. Yet how tragic is such a view, both for the world itself and for those who cling, like the inquisitors, to delusions of their own grandeur. Viewing nature as commodity, as a limitless storehouse of products for human consumption, leads inevitably to the destruction of the Earth's quite limited resources. And while all of us share in this continuing tragedy, these would-be masters of the universe suffer a doubly grievous loss, because to see nature as a commodity is not to see it at all. There's a paradox here, the idea of not seeing humans as the center of the universe. In one sense, it is, in the obvious sense. In another sense, it's true. We are, and each creature and everything is the center. He points out that this idea that humans are not the center of the universe does not mean that environmentalists regard people as less important than tall trees and tiny insects. On the contrary, it means that the quality of human life is immeasurably heightened by our being part of something greater than ourselves. That the benefits to the human species of maintaining biological diversity far outweigh the costs. That while the life of every species on the planet has its own intrinsic value, the preservation of every species is linked in some way to that of every other. He talks about how on a guided boat tour through Everglades National Park, through the seemingly endless islands of mangrove forest, visitors might or might not catch a glimpse of the endangered manatee. He says that on these boat tours, if the customers don't see a manatee as they had hoped, the tour guide will say, "This isn't Disney World, this is the real world." He says, "We are not the Alpha and Omega of God's creation. Manatees will appear according to their own schedule. And not, as would certainly be handier for marketing purposes, every hour on the hour. It demands that we step back and in so doing become more a part of the world around us." This, he says, is the process by which one becomes an environmentalist. Once the world stops being for us alone, we stop being isolated from the world. That's a very profound statement. Once the world stops being for us alone, that is to suit our purposes, our needs, we stop being isolated from the world. Once we realize that we're but one piece of a magnificent mosaic, we begin to appreciate the extraordinary treasures of the natural world, and we want to preserve them for their own sake as well as for our own. He says what we know through meditation, that we alter the tide of history by shifting our perspective, and that really is what meditation is all about, shifting our perspective. The realization that we're part of the whole is the beginning of awareness, the key to undreamed of riches, the hope for the future of the earth and all its creatures, humankind included. So we're not idle spectators, present or not, at the falling of a tree. We're participants, citizens in the natural world. I hope that some who are not planning to be involved at all in the annual Earth Day events might consider doing so, getting involved somehow. Here at the Zen Center, we're going to go out and do another of our Earth vigils as part of the local Earth Day events. I think it's April 22nd, Friday, April 22nd. We're going to saddle up and go out, and there'll be more about this in a announcement to the Sangha. If you haven't tried this, or if you haven't tried sitting with the monthly Monday Buddhist Peace Fellowship sitting, you might be surprised at how gratifying it is, how meaningful it is to sit in public in this very particular way, in this very particular context of being part of this larger movement. So now, back to what I mentioned earlier. This is about overcoming resistance. I'll be reading from an essay that's one of many in another book edited by Kenneth Kraft, co-edited by Canon Stephanie Kaza. The book is called Dharma Rain, Sources of Buddhist Environmentalism. It has dozens and dozens and dozens of really terrific essays in it. And this one is by the wonderful Joanna Macy. She was like Stephanie Kaza and Ken Kraft. She spoke at one of our symposiums that we had here at the Zen Center. And this, she has several chapters in here are by her. And this one is called Encouraging Words for Activists. How can we engage in action on behalf of Earth and not get consumed, not go crazy? We who have aligned ourselves with this effort to transform a civilization so that complex forms of life can continue are faced with something very different from the kinds of challenges that our foremothers and forefathers faced. And she begins by reflecting on some peculiarities of our situation in this 21st century on planet Earth. Six of them in particular occur to her. First, she says, there is the staggering range of the crisis, from the soil to the forest, to the air, to the seas, to the rivers, to the spasms of extinction. It's overwhelming for any single pair of eyes. Second, and concurrent to that, there is an overwhelming amount of data. You never know enough. Every time you hear mention of a new development, you think, I better bone up on that too. When can you draw a free breath? Third, it appears that our chances of pulling through are slim. We recognize this, but we don't say it much. For example, the chlorofluorocarbons we've already put into the biosphere will still be eating the biosphere for the next 15 years. How do you find the energy and motivation to act when it may be too late? These are very sobering points she makes. The fourth and related peculiarity is the taboo against acknowledging the situation. Aside from the occasional letter from Nobel laureates on the 34th page of the newspaper, the taboo against acknowledging the situation, against speaking out and naming what we're doing to ourselves. It still feels inappropriate to acknowledge this in polite society. On one level, we really intuit the severity of the crisis we're in, and on the other, we're just going along with business as usual. The press helps us by treating everything as if it were separate. Wars and hunger, radiation and AIDS, the floods in Bangladesh and the floods in the Midwest. The fifth feature is that it's increasingly dangerous to act on behalf of Earth because of repressive actions of the FBI and attacks on environmentalists by corporate-sponsored movements like Wise Use. We mentioned that earlier. I know for myself, when I do speak out, I sometimes hear ancestral voices whispering, shut up or you will be burned. We carry this fear. And then sixth, we feel so pressed. The letters to answer, the lobbying, the meetings, the fundraising, the calls to make. We get sick and tired, and we get tired and sick. Some of the people I most admire work around issues of contamination and are themselves ill. It's not an easy time to charge out, although it is the most natural choice in the world to move out and act when our larger body is threatened. It's good to be able to name why it's hard for us to do that. Now, just remember, this woman, Joanna Macy, is one of the most engaged of all Buddhist environmentalists. She has a record of decades of work. So when she's itemizing these challenges that we face, these are all challenges she has overcome. We mustn't let these things overwhelm us. And now she offers, she says, I like to reflect on some things that have helped me act for Earth. What do we have going for us? I've come to realize that we have a lot going for us. First, it helps to remember your true nature, or even more, to realize your true nature. She says, action is not something you do, it's something you are. In other words, you are not a noun, you're a verb. That is our true nature. In our old paradigm, the substantialist view of the world, that is, of a fixed self, a permanent self, rocks, atoms, molecules, trees, people, nation-states were seen as separate entities, and what happened between them, in terms of interchanges, communications, messages, relationships, was considered less real because you can't see it or weigh it or touch it. And that was true for Aristotle, Newton, and Galileo. Now, in the view that has emerged in our time, natural scientists see reality as flows, interconnecting currents of matter, energy, and information. They see that what appear to be separate entities are patterns made by flows and sustained by flows. This is what awakening confirms, that there is no self-standing entity in ourself or in anything. That we are, as they found in modern physics, we are energy. We are energy in flux. A certain kind of relatively congealed energy. That's why our bodies are relatively stable in their form. But still, it's energy. She says, to use another image, we are flames that keep our shape by burning, by the act of combustion, matter in and matter out. So action isn't a burden to be hoisted up and lugged around on our shoulders. It is something we are. The work we have to do can be seen as a kind of coming alive. More than some moral imperative, it's an awakening to our true nature, a releasing of our gifts. This flow through of energy and ideas is at every moment directed by our choice. That's our role in it. We're like a lens that can focus, or a gate that can direct this flow through by schooling our intention. In each moment we give a direction. This is an enormously important point. To realize that there, just as we say, there is no rather than talking about an enlightened person, it's more accurate to talk about enlightened activity. What this means is that there is no fixed person, that each of us is what we do. And so we don't have to think, am I an environmentalist? We just have to respond to this very, very grave need for help. Then she talks about the word apocalypse. It has been helpful to me to reflect on the meaning of apocalypse. A theologian brother who knew his Greek told me that the real meaning of the word is to uncover, to disclose. What can be disclosed in us? If we really face the magnitude of the dangers, the possibility that this may be the end of the road for our species, what can be revealed in us? People think that if we allow ourselves to experience this fear, it will paralyze us. And they think that if we don't look at it, we won't be paralyzed. But what if we were to live each moment as if it were our last? That's a central spiritual teaching, the death meditation in Buddhism, or medieval Christianity's mystery play, Everyman. Look into apocalypse and let that free you from triviality, evasion. If you're in a game and the chances of winning are minimal, and it is only minutes to the end, what does the coach say to you? He doesn't say, "It'll turn out okay, just relax." But rather, "The odds are overwhelmingly against us. Go out and give it all you've got." Use that sense of being on the brink to come alive, to discover who you really are, to let all the falseness that we imprison ourselves in be stripped away. Before Lakota warriors went into battle, they said, "Today is a good day to die." And then one other thing that she offers that helps her keep going: to remember that each one of us has been called into being at this time. I am convinced of that. We are not here by accident. Is it my imagination to think that we have chosen this? Is it not a privilege to be incarnating at a time when the stakes are really high, at a time when everything we've ever learned about interconnectedness, about trust, about courage can be put to the test? Each one of us, I believe, is a gift the earth is giving to itself now, a unique gift. Every anguish, betrayal, disappointment can even help prepare us for the work of healing. You don't need to be extraordinary. If the world is to be healed through human efforts, I am convinced it will be by ordinary people, people whose love for this life is even greater than their fear, people who can open to the web of life that called us into being and who can rest in the vitality of that larger body. And then the last thing she says is we need to be ready for surprises. The first property of systems is that the whole is more than the sum of the parts. Each time new systemic patterns form through interaction, something emerges that wasn't there before. That is a systemic property of life. You cannot predict what is going to emerge. That is why it's okay not to have a blueprint. Unburden yourself of the notion that you have to carry around a master plan to know what is the best thing to do. Lewis Mumford saw this years ago when he said that the era of the individual savior, a Buddha, a Messiah, or a Christ, was over, and that the wisdom was going to erupt through each and all of us. Transformation now is a collective event. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. without number.
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I vow to meditate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.